Osho. The sun rises in the evening. Talks on Zen. Discourse number 10. Given at the Osho Commune International, Pune, India.
The first question. The West has given birth to Aristotle, Nietzsche, Heidegger, Camus, Bourdieu, Marcel, and Sartre. Is it going to give birth to Buddhas by itself? Or is a communion with the Eastern consciousness needed? Chinmaya, the Buddha consciousness is neither Eastern nor Western. It has nothing to do with geography or history. It has nothing to do with mind as such. Mind is Eastern, Western, Indian, Chinese, Japanese, German. But the innermost pure consciousness is simply the pure sky. You cannot identify it with anything because it is unconditioned. What is East and what is West? Ways of conditioning, different ways of conditioning. What is a Hindu and what is a Jew? Different ways of conditioning. These are names of diseases. Health is neither Eastern nor Western. A child is born. And immediately, conditioning starts. Very subtle are the ways of conditioning. Directly, indirectly, we start impressing the child into a certain mold. He will speak a certain language. And each language has its ways of thinking. Each language has its emphasis, its particular direction. That's why sometimes it becomes impossible to translate to one thing from one language into another. The other language may not even have words to correspond with. The other language may have not looked at reality and life in that way. Life is infinite. The way you look at it is finite. There can be infinite ways to look at it. And the child then starts getting colored by the family, by the school, by the church, the priest, the parents, and it goes on silently. Slowly, slowly, the whole sky of consciousness is closed. Only a small window, an aperture is left open. That aperture is Indian, English, American. That aperture is Hindu, Jaina, Buddhist. That aperture is Eastern, Western. Buddhahood is to regain again the consciousness that you had brought with your birth. That uncontaminated purity, that original face, without any mask. That innocence is Buddhahood. So Buddhahood cannot be Eastern and Western. That is transcendental. You may be surprised that when a child grows in a family, and each child has to grow in a family, it is almost a must, there is no way. Some kind of family is needed. Even if it is a commune, it will have its own limitations. It may be a kibbutz, it will have its own limitations. And there is no way to bring up a child without a certain nursing surrounding. That nursing surrounding is a must. Without it, the child cannot survive. The child has to be looked after. But the child has to pay for it. It is not simple. It is very complex. The child has to continuously adjust himself to the family. Because the family is right. The father is right. The mother is right. They are powerful people. The child is helpless. He has to depend on them. He has to look up to them. He has to follow them. Right or wrong is not the question. The child has to become a shadow, an imitator. That's what Hinduism is, Christianity is. That's what Eastern and Western mind is. And these are very subtle. The child may never become aware because they are not done in one day. It goes on so slowly, just like the water falling from the mountain, falling and falling and falling. And it destroys the rocks and the stones disappear. The child has to adjust in many ways. That adjustment makes him false, inauthentic, makes him untrue, untrue to his own being. Now, psychologists have discovered that if a certain child proves to be stupid, it may not be so, because no child is born stupid. It may be just the whole surrounding that he had to adjust with the family. If the father is too intellectual, the child will have to behave in a stupid way to keep balance. If the child behaves in an intelligent way, the father is in a subtle way angry. He cannot tolerate an intelligent child. He never tolerates anybody who is trying to be intelligent than him. He will force the child to remain inferior. Not withstanding what he goes on saying. And the child will learn the trick of behaving like a fool. Because when he behaves like a fool, everything goes okay. Everything is perfectly okay. The father may show his displeasure on the surface, but deep down he is satisfied. He always likes fools around him. Surrounded by fools, he is the most intelligent person. Because of this, for hundreds of years, women have learned a trick. They never try to be intellectuals. The husband won't like it. Not that they are not intelligent. They are as much intelligent as men. But they have to learn. Have you not watched it? If the wife is more educated, the husband feels a little bad about it. No man wants to marry a woman who is more educated than him. more famous than him. Not only that, in small things, if the woman is taller, no man wants to marry her. Maybe it is just because of this. Women have decided biologically also not to become too tall. There may be some psychological reason in it. Otherwise, you will not get a husband. If you are too intelligent, you will not get a husband. The woman has to pretend that she always remains a baby, childish. So the husband can feel good that the woman leans on him. In a family, the child comes in a ready-made situation. Everything is already there. He has to fix himself in it. He has to adjust in it. And he cannot be himself. If he tries to be himself, he always gets into trouble. He starts feeling guilty. He has to adjust. Whatever the cost, the survival is the most important thing, the first thing. Other things are secondary. So each child has to adjust with the family, with the parent, with the geography, with the history, with the idiosyncrasies of the people around him, with all kinds of prejudices, stupid beliefs, superstitions. By the time you become aware or you become a little bit independent, you are so conditioned. The conditioning has gone so deep in the blood and the bones and the marrow that you cannot get out of it. What is Buddhahood? Buddhahood is getting out of this whole conditioning. This is cutting the roots. You can go in the garden and watch. One thing, you will be surprised. When a new tree is planted, the tree has to adjust with other trees which are already in existence. Naturally. It has to find ways. It can grow its branches only where there is a space. If other trees are already occupying the space, it cannot grow in those directions. It has to find a way in the existing situation. It has to adjust. Maybe it cannot grow branches to all sides. It cannot be balanced. It can grow only branches to the north, because there is some space. Other three sides are already occupied. It becomes lopsided. It grows the branch too much towards the north, and all other sides remain ungrown. It is lopsided. And this is on the surface. If you go deep, the same is happening with the roots. There are already roots of other trees. They have already taken possession of the earth. The new tree has to find ways. It has to avoid the places that have been already occupied. It has to find new sources of water, if it can find. It cannot grow its roots as they would have grown naturally if there were no trees around. But that is not possible for a child. And that same happens to humanity. The child grows branches in directions which are available. The child grows roots. Those roots become entangled with the roots of the parents. And they remain entangled if you don't cut them. It is very difficult to find a really grown-up person. People only grow old, they never grow up. And growing old is not growing up. They are not synonymous. Growing old is moving towards death. Growing up is moving towards more life, more abundant life. Great decisiveness is needed on your part. People remain entangled. A man may be 50, but he still behaves with his wife as if he is behaving with his mother. He still expects the same from his wife as he used to expect from the mother. He is a child. The woman may be 50, but he still expects from the husband the same kind of behavior as he expected from the father. This is not growing up. And because it cannot be met, your husband is not your father, and your wife is not your mother, then there is frustration. This is entanglement with the roots. You are still entangled. The father may be dead, the mother may be dead, but your roots still go on moving in the same directions where they learned in your childhood to move. Now the space is available, but you have forgotten how to grow in those spaces which have newly become available. A space becomes every day available. But you have forgotten, completely forgotten. Or your few parts have died. They have simply disappeared. It is very difficult to find a man who is whole. Just somebody's hands are too big, and the brain too small. Somebody's brain is too big, and the heart is almost non-existing, zero. People are living only in parts, and to live in parts is to live in misery. A Buddha is one who lives as a whole, as an organic whole. East and West are irrelevant to Buddha consciousness. Chinmaya, if Buddhas can happen in the East without the help of the West, why they can't happen in the West without the help of the East? And who has told you that they have not happened in the West already? Just the names are different there. They don't call it Buddha consciousness. They call it Christ consciousness. It is the same. Master Eckhart or Jacob Burney or Gurdjieff, these are Buddhas. They have been happening in the West as much as they have been happening in the East. Only names differ. No support of the East is needed. No communion. A Buddha is not a communion of East and West. A Buddha is a transcendence of all that is East and West. A transcendence of all divisions. Not a communion. Not a meeting, but a transcendence. Not a synthesis of the opposites, but going beyond the opposites. A Buddha is a pure sky. Knows no boundaries. It can happen anywhere, in any time. But the Eastern ego feels very good to think that Buddhas can happen only in the East. And when Indians use the word East, they simply mean India. They don't mean China. They don't mean Japan. They can't mean Pakistan. Their east simply means India. And if you insist in India to where, then it never means South India. It means North India. If you go on insisting, you will find finally that the Indian simply means that he is himself the person who can become the Buddha, nobody else. If you go on insisting, finally you will find that he is declaring himself, that's all. That he can become the Buddha, nobody else. Deep down is nothing but an ego game. Forget all these ego games. Get out of these egoistic assertions. In time also the same has happened again and again, just as it happens in space. India is a certain space. In time also the same happens. Now there are people who say, only in the past Buddhas used to happen, they cannot happen now. They are not going to happen in the future. This is a Kali Yuga. This is the worst time. Why this is the worst time? Time is always the same. The birds sing the same songs as they used to sing in Buddha's time. And the trees still bloom the same way. And the rivers flow the same. The stars move in the same way. This is the same dance. Time cannot make any difference. Why only in the past? Again, the ego is involved. With the past, we are too much attached. Our past, our heritage. We think of our past in glorious terms. That gives us great satisfaction. And it helps us and consoles us that we have been at the top. Nobody has ever been at that height as we have been. It helps us to feel good, because when we see around and the real situation, it is so ugly that we need some dreams to help us. And there are two kinds of dreams possible. Either you dream of the past, that's what religions have been doing. Or you dream of future, that's what materialistic religions are doing, communism, fascism, Nazism. They dream of the future. They say in the future is the utopia, the golden age. Old religions used to say in the past is the golden age. Nobody says right now is the golden age. And I would like to declare it to you right now. Now is the only golden time. Buddhas happen now. Because there is no other time. And Buddhas happen here. And the here contains all the whole space. And the now contains the whole time. But they happen only when somebody takes the decision to go beyond all boundaries. When somebody risks to go out of the herd and the herd psychology. When one decides not to be a part of the mob. That's what you are. When you are a Hindu, you are a part of a mob. You are a Jaina, you are a part of a mob. You are a Christian, you are part of a mob. When you drop out of the mob and you become free and you start living your life the way you want to live it, when you accept yourself totally, when there is no self-condemnation, when you don't compare yourself with anybody or with any ideals, and then you don't put yourself down again and again, when you start living joyously your life the way God wants you to live, God has not given you birth to live somebody else's life. If he wanted a Krishna, he would have created a Krishna. If he wanted a Christ, he would have created a Christ. Why Chinmaya? He wants not a Chinmaya. The Hasid mystic Jusya was dying, and he started praying, and he was trembling, and tears were flowing down his eyes, and he was shaking. And somebody asked, "What is the matter? Why you are trembling?" He was saying that, "I am trembling for a certain reason. This is my last moment. I am dying. Soon I will be facing my God. And I am certain that he is not going to ask me, Jusya, why you were not a Moses. If he asks, I will say, Lord, because you didn't give me the qualities of a Moses. There will be no problem. He is not going to ask me why you were not the Rabbi Akiva. I will tell him, sir, you never gave me the qualities of being a Akiva. That's why. But I am trembling if he asks, Jusya, why you were not a Jusya. Then I will have nothing to answer. Then I will have to look down in shame. That's why I am trembling and these tears are flowing. My whole life I tried to become Moses or Akiva or somebody else. And I completely forgot that he wanted me to be just Jusya and nobody else. Now I am trembling. Now I am afraid if he asks this question, what I am going to answer? How I will be able to raise my eyes when he will ask why you were not Jusya? You were given all the qualities of being a Jusya. How you missed? And I have missed in imitating others. Remember, always remember Jusya. It is one of the most significant incidences in any mystic's life. If you remember it, it will help. You have to be your own self. Utterly your own self. Don't imitate. Don't follow the past. Don't follow any ideals. Because they are all herd psychology. You slip out of them. Be a lion and move out of the mob and start living your life as truly as possible. Because if you cannot be true to your own life, how can you be true to others? And by being true to your own self, you will transcend all limitations of countries, religions, political dogmas, East, West. You will transcend all limitations by being yourself. Just think of it. If you are just yourself, will you be a German? Or will you be a Japanese? Or a Burmese? Just being yourself. Who you will be? A Christian, a Hindu, a Mohammedan? You will not be. In all these definitions, you will not find yourself. You will start growing beyond definitions. Buddha consciousness is transcendental consciousness. It has nothing to do with East or West. The second question, I have always dreamt of becoming a world famous man, rich and successful. Bhagwan, can you help me in the fulfillment of my desires? No, sir. Not at all. Never. Because your desire is suicidal. I cannot help you to commit suicide. I can help you to grow and be, but I cannot help you to commit suicide. I cannot help you to destroy yourself for nothing. Ambition is poison. If you want to be a better musician, I can help you. But don't think in terms of becoming world famous. If you want to be a better poet, I can help you. But don't think in terms of Nobel Prizes. If you want to be a good painter, I can help you. I help creativity. But creativity has nothing to do with name and fame, success and money. And I am not saying that if they come, then you have to renounce them. If they come, it is okay. Enjoy them. But don't let them become your motivation. Because when a person is trying to be successful, how he can be really a poet? His energy is political. How can he be poetic? If a person is trying to become rich, how can he be a real painter? His whole energy is concerned with being rich. A painter needs his whole energy in the painting. And the painting is here now. And richness will come somewhere in the future. May come, may not come. There is no necessity. It is all accidental. Success is accidental. Fame is accidental. But bliss is not accidental. I can help you to be blissful. You can paint and be blissful. Whether the painting becomes famous or not, whether you become a Picasso or not, is not the point at all. But I can help you to paint in such a way that while you are painting, even Picasso may feel jealous of you. You can be utterly lost in your painting. And that is the real joy. Those are the moments of love and meditation. Those are the moments which are divine. A divine moment is one in which you are utterly lost, when your boundaries disappear, when for a moment you are not and God is. But I cannot help you to be successful. I am not against success, let me remind you again. I am not saying don't be successful. I have nothing against it. It's perfectly good. What I am saying is, don't be motivated by it. Otherwise, you will miss painting, you will miss poetry, you will miss the song that you are singing right now, and when the success comes, you will have only empty hands. Because nobody can be fulfilled by success. Success cannot nourish. It has no nutrients in it. Success is just hot air. Just the other night I was reading a book on Somerset Maugham. Conversations with Willie. The book is written by Somerset Maugham's nephew Robin Maugham. Now Somerset Maugham is one of the most famous, successful, rich persons of this age. But the memoirs are revealing. Listen to these words. Robin Mom writes about his famous and successful uncle Somerset Maugham. He was certainly the most famous author alive and the saddest. You know, he said to me, I shall be dead very soon and I don't like the idea of it at all. And this statement was made when he was 91. I'm a very old party, he said, but that does not make it any easier for me. He was rich, world famous and all that, and at the age of 91 he was still making a fortune, even though he had not written a single word for ages. The royalties from his books still literally flowed in from all over the world, and so did the fan letters. At this moment, four of his plays were running in German. His play The Circle had been brilliantly revived in England, and The Constant Wife had just been turned into a musical. One of his most famous novels of human bondage was soon to be made into a film which might bring him as many millions of dollars as did Rain, The Moon and Sixpence, and The Razor's Edge. Unfortunately, the one reward all his talent and success had not given him was happiness. He was the saddest man in the world. What is the happiest memory of your life? I asked him. He said, I can't think of a single moment. I looked around, says the nephew. The drawing room and its immensely valuable furniture and pictures and paintings and art objects that his success has enabled him to acquire. His villa itself and the wonderful garden, a fabulous setting on the edge of the Mediterranean, were worth £600,000. He had 11 personal servants, but he was not happy. The next day, he was looking into his Bible and said, I have come across the quotation, what shall it profit a man if he gain the whole world and lose his own soul? He clasped and unclasped his hands in agony and said again, I must tell you, my dear Robin, that the text used to hang opposite my bed when I was a child. And then I took him for a walk in the garden and he said, you know, when I die, they will take it all away from me. Every tree, the whole house, and every stick of furniture. I shall not even be able to take a single table with me. And he was very sad. And he was trembling. For a while he was silent as we walked through a grove of orange trees. And then he said, I have been a failure the whole way through my life. I tried to comfort him. You are the most famous writer alive. Surely that means something, I asked. I wish I had never written a single word, he answered. What it has brought to me, my whole life has been a failure. And now it is too late to change, he said. It is too late. And tears came into his eyes. What success can bring to you? Now this man, Somerset Maugham, lived in vain, lived long, 91 years, could have been a very, very contented man, fulfilled. But if success can give it, then only. If riches can give it, then only. If a big villa and servants can give it, then only. In the ultimate analysis of life, name and fame are just irrelevant. All that matters in the final reckoning is how you lived each moment of your life. Was it a joy? Was it a celebration? And in small things, were you happy? Taking a bath, sipping the tea, cleaning the floors, roaming around the garden, planting trees, talking to a friend, or sitting silently with your beloved, or looking at the moon, or just listening to the birds. Were you happy in all these moments? Was each moment a transformed moment of luminous happiness? Was it radiant with joy? That's what matters. You ask me, can I help you in the fulfillment of your desire? No, not at all. Because that desire is your enemy. It will destroy you. And one day, when you will come across the sentence in the Bible, what shall it profit a man if he gain the whole world and lose his own soul? Then you will weep in frustration. And then you will say, and now it is too late to change. It is too late. I say to you, right now, it is not too late. Something can be done. You can change your life totally from the very roots. I can help you to go through an alchemical change. But I cannot guarantee any success in the worldly sense. I can guarantee every success in the inner world. I can make you rich as any Buddha. And only Buddhas are rich. The people who have only worldly things around them are not really rich. Poor people, defooling themselves and others that they are rich. Deep down is the beggars. They are not the real emperors. Buddha came to a city. And the king was a little hesitant to go and receive him. His old prime minister said, if you don't go to receive him, then take my resignation. Then I cannot serve you anymore. The king said, but why? And the man was very indispensable. Without him, the king will be lost. He was the real key of his power. He said, but why? Why you insist? Why should I go to receive a beggar? And the prime minister, the old man said, you are a beggar and he is the emperor, that's why. Either you go to receive him, otherwise you are not worth serving. The king had to go. Reluctantly he went. But when he saw Buddha, he touched the feet of the old man, his prime minister, and he said, you were right, he is the king, I am a beggar. Life is strange. Here sometimes beggars are kings and kings are beggars. Don't be deceived by the appearance. Look in. The heart is rich. when it throbs with joy. The heart is rich when it falls in harmony with Tao, with the nature, with the ultimate law of life, with Dhamma. The heart is rich when you are in harmony with the whole. That is the only richness there is. Otherwise, one day you will weep and you will say it is too late. I cannot help you to destroy your life. I am here to enhance your life. I am here to give you life abundance. The third question, is the ego still working when I feel joy and contentment? Champak, when the joy is there, there is no ego. But when the joy is gone, the ego comes back. And when the ego comes back, it turns the joy into an experience. Otherwise, when the joy is there, there is no experiencer and no experience, there is no division. It is not that you feel joy, you are joy. When the joy is there, you are not there. Joy is, only joy is, just joy. But sooner or later, you are not still capable to contain that joy forever. The window closes, the doors are shut, the fragrance disappears, the music becomes distant and distant and disappears. The ego is back, and there was this boy. What a beautiful experience! It was great, fantastic. And now, that which was not an experience had been reduced into an experience. You ask me, is the ego still working when I feel joy and contentment? When you are really in joy and contentment, the ego is not, cannot be. Because contentment cannot be with the ego. It is impossible. They can't exist together. It has never been heard. Their coexistence is impossible. When the joy and contentment is there, only God is. But I can understand your question, Champak. The question arises later on, when the ego comes back and the moment of joy has disappeared and the ego takes possession. It is very greedy. It takes possession of everything. It hoards everything. It reduces every living thing into a dead thing. Because only dead things can be accumulated. Now it says, keep it as a memory. It was a great thing. Now it is reduced into memory. Now the ego says, have this kind of joy more and more. Create it more. And you know, you were not the creator of it. It had come when you were not. It had come unasked. It had come on its own. It has appeared out of the blue. You were not the creator of it. You were not the manufacturer of it. You had not put it together. It was something from the beyond that suddenly took possession of you, shook you up, bathed you, and in a moment, you were sunlit. And you had forgotten all misery and all anguish and all pain. You were not a man in that moment. It was a glimpse of Buddhahood. Just a lightning experience. But the ego cannot miss. Once it is gone, the ego immediately jumps and takes possession of it. It stores it in the memory and goads you to have more of it. Now you are in a trouble. You don't know what to do, how to bring that joy again. This happens every day here. When new people come to me and they start meditating, suddenly one day it is there, the benediction. And they are thrilled. They are ecstatic. But the ego takes possession of it. And then it becomes more and more difficult to happen. Then they are worried. It happened. Now why it is not happening? It happened because you were unaware of it. It happened because you were not asking for it. You could not have asked because you had no previous experience. It happened because there was no search for it. It happened because you were not seeking for it. You could not have sought it. It was unknown. Now you know something of it. And because you know, you are searching for it. And because you are searching, you are. In the search, the seeker persists, remains. And the seeker is the barrier. That is the whole message of yoga and his sodoka. Whole message that the seeker is the barrier. God cannot be sought. God comes. You have just to be receptive, available. That's all. When for the first time in meditation you feel ecstasy arising, it is not your doing. Beware. You are not doing anything, it is happening to you. It is a sheer gift. Feel grateful. Don't think in terms that you are the doer. Don't pat your back. Don't say, look, I have done it. If you have done it, you will be in trouble. It will not come again. You have become cunning, clever. Your innocence is lost. So whenever beautiful experiences of joy, contentment, love, beatitude, benediction happen, remember one thing. Always remember that you are not the manipulator of them. They come. Feel thankful, grateful, and forget all about them. Don't store them in the memory and don't become greedy about them. If you become greedy, ego has come in, and with revenge. And the ego has started poisoning you again. Champak, ego disappears many times. In ordinary life too, it disappears many times. But people don't know how to keep those moments of purity intact, unpolluted by the ego that will come later on, that is bound to come. It has nothing to do with meditation as such. Meditation is only one of the ways to make you available, to help you become passive, receptive, feminine. But it happens. Just seeing a bird on the wing, and it can happen. Ramakrishna's first samadhi happened that way. He was only 13, and he was coming from his farm to the home, and was passing by a village pond. And few swans suddenly flew from the pond. The sky was dark, full of dark clouds. Against the backdrop of dark clouds, those white swans flashed like lightning. The moment was so pure, of such utter beauty. Ramakrishna fell then and there on the ground in great prayer. He was struck by God. He remained unconscious for a few hours. Somebody discovers and people carried him home. That was his first samadhi. When he opened his eyes after a few hours, he was a totally different man. Those eyes were no more the old one. They had a new sign. The face was no more the old one. It has a new glory. The boy was transformed. People started worshipping the boy. People started coming from far and wide just to see what has happened. Something divine has penetrated him. And he was not doing anything. He was just passing by the pond. But he never allowed his ego to take possession of it. When people will say, "What you did," he said, "I have not done anything. It has happened." And he never was greedy for it to happen again. Otherwise he would have missed. And it started happening again and again. Then small things started triggering it. You cannot find swans flying against the dark clouds every day. But that is not the point. That was just the beginning. Then small things. Somebody will smile and it will happen. A flower by the side of the road. And Ramakrishna will look at it and he will go into ecstasy. He will no more be here. Or somebody will say something. Just the sound. Somebody chanting a mantra. Just the sound. Or somebody playing on a veena. Just the sound. And he will go in ecstasy. Later on it was so difficult for his disciples. To take him anywhere was a problem. On the road, walking, and suddenly he will be gone. He will disappear. Wherever he will go, anything. In fact, slowly, slowly, all is divine. Slowly, slowly, everything. That must have happened to Basu, the same mystic and poet. The ancient pond. A frog jumps in. Plop. Basu must have went into a deep ecstasy. Just a plop. The sound of the frog jumping in the ancient pond was enough, more than enough. The door opens. It opens to you too. God is generous. But you miss the point because you misinterpret it. Sometimes it happens while you are making love. More often when you make love, because that is your deepest experience. Ramakrishna must have been a very aesthetic soul. Otherwise, who goes into such orgasm by seeing few swans flying by against the black clouds? Must have been of immense aesthetic sensibility. It was enough. he went into an orgasmic state. Ordinarily, people are not so sensitive. They have become very harsh. Just to survive, they have gathered an armor around themselves, just to protect. They are afraid of being vulnerable. But while making love, one becomes vulnerable. In that intimacy, the glimpse comes. You are lost. You are possessed by some energy which is not your own. You are tiny compared to it. It is huge, enormous. But don't take possession of it later on. The ego is coming. When it comes, thank God. When it goes, thank God. But don't become in any way a doer. Remain a non-doer. The fifth question. You say we need only declare our own enlightenment to ourselves. But what about the gap, the discontinuity, the quantum leap, the death and the rebirth? Is the declaration a device, a way of creating the effect for the cause to follow? Is this an acceptance of enlightenment with a small e, knowing that one day the big E will come in a sudden flash of lightning? Confused. Krishna Prem, what are you talking about? What gap? What discontinuity? What quantum leap? You are it. The gap is just in your dream. The gap exists not. You have never been other than enlightened. Enlightenment is the stuff you are made of. You say that you say we need only declare our own enlightenment to ourselves. What about the gap, the discontinuity, the quantum leap, the death and the rebirth? Nothing ever dies. Nothing is ever reborn. How can there be rebirth? Because nothing ever dies. It is all one process. It is all one continuum. Life has never known death. You are dreaming. I have heard a Taoist story. A great emperor was sitting by the side of his dying son, the only son. All his hopes were shattered. He had only one child, he was old, and the child was dying. And the physicians had failed and they had said that now this is the last night. He was sitting, crying and weeping. He could not sleep. The whole night he sat by the side of the bed. By the morning, tired, exhausted, he fell asleep in the chair. He dreamt that he had a very, very big kingdom on some other planet. He has huge golden palaces. He has 12 sons, all beautiful, intelligent. You cannot think of any improvement in the situation. It is perfect. And then the boy died. The wife screamed in pain. The king's dream was disturbed. He opened his eyes and started laughing. The wife thought he had gone mad. People gathered. The wife asked, "What are you doing? Why are you laughing? And you had loved the boy so much, and why are you laughing?" He said, "I am laughing because now what to believe. Just a moment before, I was dreaming. And I had 12 sons. So beautiful, so strong, Superman, so intelligent, incomparable. And I had a big kingdom with golden palaces. This palace looks just like a poor man's hut. And the moment you screamed, the dream disappeared, and my 12 sons, and the golden palace, and the kingdom, and all. And when I was dreaming about those 12 sons, and the kingdom, and the palace, they were so real that I had forgotten you and the dying son and this kingdom and this me. Now I am laughing. For whom to weep? Those 12 sons which have disappeared, or this one who has disappeared? That's why I am laughing. If the gap exists only in a dream, there is no way to bridge it. Because the bridge that you will make will be a dream bridge. All that is needed is wake up. Krishna Prem, wake up. Open your eyes. Just see, all is dream. Sometimes with open eyes you dream, and sometimes with closed eyes you dream. Sometimes you have nightmares, and sometimes you have daymares. But that is the only difference. They are all mares. Wake up. Only the witnessing self is the reality. All else that you are seeing is a projected film. Turn in and see that you are enlightened. It is not a question of bridging the gap. It is only a question of recognizing, remembering. So it can happen any moment. The moment you allow it to happen, the moment you permit it to happen, it can happen. All that I go on saying to you is just to help you to permit it. It is not going to create enlightenment. It is just helping you to permit it, to accept it. Is the declaration a device, a way of creating the effect for the cause to follow? Enlightenment is not the effect of any cause. Enlightenment is already there. It has not to follow any cause. It is your very ground. Nothing is needed to be done to attain it. See the emphasis. The emphasis is not on doing something. The emphasis is only on remembering. You have a purse somewhere in your pocket and you have forgotten it. And you are feeling miserable. And you are feeling now you are in a strange city. Nobody knows you. Where you are going to eat? You don't have any money. And the money is there. Just you have forgotten the purse. Or maybe you have misplaced it. And you go on looking in the left side pocket and it may be in the right side pocket. And again and again you look and again you feel more and more. Afraid, insecure. What is going to happen? Who is going to give you food today? But nothing has to be done really. All that is needed is a remembering that where you have put it. Doing is not the thing. Only awareness. That is the emphasis of Zen. Yoga emphasizes on doing. Do this, do that. That's why yoga satisfies people's egos very much. Because it gives you infinite possibilities to evolve in the world of the ego. So many postures. So much rules, so much discipline, pranayama and exercises, and it goes on and on. And you feel that I have done so much, now I am coming home, now I am coming closer, 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 but you never come, you never arrive. Zen is a sudden phenomenon. It is not a gradual process. The whole approach is that you have never been otherwise. You are enlightened. From the very beginning, you are a Buddha. I am repeating it day after day. So that this constant hammering on your head someday may break the forgetfulness, the layer of forgetfulness. And any day the forgetfulness is gone, it will come. It will come like an upsurge. It will well up in you. You say, Krishna Prem, is this an acceptance of enlightenment with a small e? Knowing that one day the big E will come in sudden flash of lightning? Enlightenment is enlightenment. Whether with big E or a small E, it makes no difference. It will not be different with a capital E. It is the same phenomenon. When I go on saying to you, it is not creating an enlightenment with a small e. No. It cannot create enlightenment at all. That's what I am saying. That's what yoga is singing. Nothing can create enlightenment. You have fallen asleep. I am shouting. And sometimes I have really to shout. Just the other day Vivek was saying that you were shouting this morning so much that I am feeling shaken, jarry. My nerves are on edge. Good. So I will have to do a little more shouting. Sooner or later, how can you avoid waking up? How long you can avoid waking up? Jesus says to his disciples, go on the housetops and shout. The Hasid mystic Akiba used to actually do it. He will go on the housetops and will shout. In the marketplace, he will go on somebody's housetop and will shout. And he will say, people, what are you doing? Awake! Remember God! And of course, people who are in the marketplace will become very much afraid when he will shout. Remember, what are you doing? Again? Again doing the same stupid thing? He was constantly moving in the marketplace and will hold people and will shake them and will say, remember, he must have been a nuisance. All masters are. When they become too much, people have to get rid of them. They crucified Jesus because he must have become too much. Too much shouting. And won't allow them even a night's sleep. They had to poison Socrates. He must have been a nuisance around Athens. He was. It is said that people were even afraid to meet him on the streets. Because if he sees you, he will catch hold of you. People were so afraid that they will not say even hello. Because he will say, what do you mean? Wait, let us discuss it. Let us go deep into it. Now even hello and you are caught. It is said that people will see him and they will escape into side streets or will hide somewhere, let him pass. It must have become unbearable. Then they decided that it is better to finish this man. A master is a constant shouting in your sleep. But he has to go on doing it, whether you listen or not, whether it becomes unbearable, whether you feel jarry, shaken, on the edge of nerves. He has to go on and on. He has to stir you. He has to penetrate your sleep. And the sleep is long. For centuries you have slept. You have completely forgotten how to open your eyes. A master has virtually to hammer you into wakefulness. Friedrich Nietzsche used to say that I philosophize with a hammer. I don't know about him. But I certainly teach with a hammer. I preach with a hammer. And the more closer you come, the more I will shout at you. Only then there is a possibility that someday you may open your eyes in spite of yourself. There is no difference between the small e and the capital E. Enlightenment is simply enlightenment. the sixth question, in surrendering to you, am I surrendering to myself? Nirvesh. In asking it, you have lost the way. Just few days before, Nirvesh was there in darshan and was saying to me that now it is enough. Enough is enough. For 1 year I have been wandering. Now I surrender everything to you. Now take possession of me and lead me wherever you want. Now this question, is surrendering to you, in surrendering to you, am I surrendering to myself? Yes. If you really surrender to me, you have surrendered to your real self. Because I am one with the real self of all. That is the meaning of God. I am no more separate from the whole. I am where you also should be. I am just a reflection of your innermost core. You cannot see within it yourself, because you are not yet able to go into those deeper realms of your being, but you can see it in me. The Master is nothing but an outer reflection of the innermost core. Bowing to a Master is bowing to your real self. So yes, if you really surrender to me, you are surrendering to yourself. But if you are surrendering to me in order to surrender to yourself, you have not surrendered to me at all. And then you miss the whole point. Do you get it? If you are surrendering to me only in order to surrender to yourself, then you have not surrendered to me. When surrendering to me, you forget all about yourself. That is surrender. Surrender means you efface yourself. You say, I am no more. Master, now you be. I am no more. From this moment I cease to be. If you can do that, you will attain to yourself. The last question. Bhagwan, you have said that all the meditations should be dropped. Because of your blessings, so many beautiful experiences have been attained. Meditating on that inner blue-green flame, even in that flame I see your eyes, your face, your whole being. It feels as if the whole existence is pouring into me. Then again it becomes meditation on you. These blissful moments come and go on their own. I have no control over them. Even so, should I try to drop this? Is this also a meditation? Please explain. Nirupam, how can you drop it if these moments come on their own? How can you drop them? And when I say all meditations have to be dropped, I mean all meditations that you do. I'm not talking about those meditations that happen. They are gifts from God. receive them with great joy, celebration. Receive them into your heart. You cannot stop them, and there is no need either. When I say drop all meditations, I mean the meditations that you have been doing on your own. They have to be done in the beginning, otherwise you will never be able to drop them. The effort has to be made so that it can be dropped. But the real beauty is in dropping. But you can drop only if you have been doing it. Remember it. There may be few new people who have not done meditations, and they may feel very good. They will say, okay, so why do? There is no need to do when one has to drop. No. You can drop only if you do. Only a rich man can distribute his riches, can renounce his riches. The poor man cannot do it. First you have, only then you can drop. So I am not saying don't start meditation. When one starts meditation, one has to be a doer. In the beginning, meditation is a kind of effort. But that has to be so. In the beginning, you cannot expect more. But don't be caught in that. There is another quality of meditation. Prepare for that. Slowly, slowly doing meditation, few moments will come which are not of your doing. Then shift from doing to those moments which are not of your doing. Then slowly, slowly go on dropping the effort and let the effortless spontaneity arise in you. And that's what is happening to Nirupam. You need not drop anything. You say these blissful moments come and go on their own. I have no control over them. That's how it should be. If you have control over them, then they cannot be very beautiful. And they cannot be divine. Your control means the ego control. And if you control, they will be smaller than you. When they are beyond your control, they are bigger than you. They come. They suddenly are there. They overwhelm you. For a moment, you are not part of this world. You walk on the earth and yet your feet don't touch the earth. For a moment, you are transported into some other reality, a separate reality, a timeless reality, a spaceless space. These moments have to be cherished, allowed, welcomed, with great reverence. Open up yourself for these moments. This is the way God comes. And the really, really last question. This morning, I sit tall before you at this course. A kind of defiance rushes through my veins and throbs with a rumbling, rivering of fire. The words courage and dignity well up inside me, congealing into a silently exploding, roaring cry. Tears stream down my face and my chest heaves under the piercing painfulness of centuries of sobs. I keep on looking at you directly with a kind of will-willing beyond its own willfulness, a crescendo of undreamed of intensity possesses me with every sort of emotion, all at once soaring into an imploring prayer. I imagine raising my empty fists at the winds, above the mountain top at thunder and at the blackness of the dark, a desire so great that it cannot find an object, an urging so strong that I cannot deny it, reverberates within the masses of my soul and I keep on looking, without anger, without fear, proud but not proud, knowing but not knowing, and I know you know. My naked soul faces the enormity of your being with the power of its own helplessness. Your eyes, understanding, emanate volts of light into my heart, making the painful burning, yearning even more. And then you enter without sound, with the softness of a petal dropping through a brilliant summer sky. Divya, this is the way the sun rises in the evening. Allow it more and more, celebrate it more and more. This is the way God comes in. Enough for today.